welcome in everybody to the Chris Collinsworth podcast, and joined today by our capologist, Mr. Brad Spielberger, and our head of R&D here at PFF, Mr. Eric Eager, and kind of head of everything else as well, as we prepare to go off to the combine and dazzle them with all our new stuff from PFF for this year, which is going to be great. But before we look ahead, let's take a minute and look back. This is the first time I've had a chance to talk about the Super Bowl, and it was an amazing day. It really was. Looking back on it, I think it was one of the hardest things that I ever personally had to try and do, because I knew going into the game that no matter what I did, I was going to be biased for and against the Cincinnati Bengals. There was no way out of it, right? I knew going into that broadcast, that was exactly what the storyline was going to be. But I have to say, coming out of it, and it's not like I go searching through the archives of what everybody's written and said about me on Twitter, because that's the quickest way to the funny farm. But it really wasn't a lot of that. I think that for the most part, it was just a great game that had a couple of calls, one that went against each football team, that were really tough calls, but they seemed to, maybe they balanced out, who knows. But talking about the Jalen Ramsey, what wasn't pass interference, and then of course the Logan Wilson pass interference call at the end of the game. And let's take them one at a time here, because it was so key in the game. Jalen Ramsey, basically T. Higgins sort of had his face mask and dragged him to the ground and went off on a, whatever it was, 75-yard touchdown to start the second half. And I've seen since then the officials talk about that there wasn't a grab and a twist on the face mask, which concerned me a little bit, because if that's not a face mask penalty, right? Let's say that they, and this happens sometimes in football, and especially with the officials, that if something, is not quite right, they explain it away, but then you also establish a precedent. So if that's not a foul, guess what we're going into training camp with next year? And everybody on the planet is going to start working on, how do I grab that face mask and pull it down at the same time I'm catching the ball? So was there any doubt in your guys' minds that that was a foul and should have been called?
Yeah, I think it was a foul, right? And even like if he would have just grabbed his shoulder and thrown him to the ground, isn't that offensive pass interference? I mean, the face mask. Yeah, I think the face mask just sort of exacerbates what was already true, which was that T. Higgins pushed off in like a very aggressive way. And I know, like, I think the disappointing part about that play is it was part of a theme, right? There were no judgment call penalties really in that game until the final drive, the second to last drive. And so, I have an issue with it. It's offensive pass interference, but if the official said, look, like, we've watched these playoff games all January and February, and we think the product is better when we don't call that many things, then stay consistent with that. Because I actually thought I didn't think the game was that great, but I thought that was a good part of the game, was that, the game moved nicely and there weren't holding penalties every 5 minutes and all that kind of stuff. And to me, that was part, they were erring on the side of not calling anything. And in that particular play, they missed a pretty big error. They missed a pretty big penalty, but it was part of the theme of, like, the only penalties in that game, like I said, until like the last drive of the game, were things they had to call, like false start. And they didn't even call a false start on the Rams on the Logan Wilson play, but things that they had to call, and they were just basically, for every judgment play, they were just kind of letting them play.
Yeah, that was for me as well. That was one of the real treats of the game, was that it had a flow and it had, some motion. And you did have, I think that those two teams were the number one and number three least penalized team. So we talked to Ron Torbert the day before, and they did factor that in to some extent. They think that one of the reasons fewer penalties are called into playoffs is they're better teams, they're better trained, they're, you know, whatever the case, and that's a big reason why they've made it as far as they did. Brad, I'll let you make a comment on that one as well. And then I think we should move on to the Logan Wilson play, because that would have basically brought the Super Bowl down to a 4th-and-8, I think it would have been. And we had not, to Eric's point, and a point I made on the game as well, that we just had not seen those kind of calls. And in particular, that sort of, I probably called it ticky-tack, knowing my limited vocabulary, kind of call at the end of it. And all the while, I'm thinking, all right, let's make a point here and not go crazy and stir up this whole I'm biased in favor of the Bengals or against the Rams or any of that kind of stuff. So I was trying to make it as quickly get in and out as fast as I could. But I thought that was completely out of character for what we saw in the game.
Yeah, so I'm definitely a, you know, let the boys play type of guy, and I do appreciate that there were so few penalties. Like Eric said, I think it was only pre-snap stuff until then. Part of me, too, with the Logan Wilson call is I think if it wasn't a linebacker on a smaller wide receiver, like if that was a corner going up against Mike Evans, does that get called? Probably not. So that was kind of the thinking there as well. And the Ramsey thing, my only comment there is that's why cornerback is probably the hardest position to play in the NFL.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just so many different ways of looking at that game, but it really felt like from the Bengals standpoint, A, they wouldn't have, you know, to jump out and grab the lead with the first play of the second half and boom, go right down the field. That obviously was a humongous play, but one play really for 4th-and-8 at the end of that one, it would have been some amazing excitement, and they were limited and they were down to just one wide receiver. And for the fact that the Rams came back and won that game, literally with Matthew Stafford with one arm tied behind his back, because he just didn't have Odell Beckham Jr., who played great in the beginning part of that game. And by the way, one of the things that I wanted to get in that we never really got in on the broadcast. We had a long talk with Odell in the game or before the game. And apparently he's been to some really dark places over the last 3 or 4 years with all the injuries. And now he's got to go through all that again. And you saw some of that emotion come out in him at the end of the game, just in tears, crying, knowing the kind of rehab he had in front of him one more time. But he had his moment in the sun. He was brilliant in the first quarter and a half, or however long he lasted in that game.
Yeah, it's very interesting because last year we did a study, because like in the Super Bowl last year, I thought that everybody was talking about the offensive line, and in reality, it was much about secondary receivers in my mind. If you can flood another team with your secondary and they only have one option, it's super hard. And actually what we showed in our analysis last year was secondary receivers matter the most in the regular season, but they matter even more in the playoffs, right? In the playoffs, usually a team that's in the playoffs has good enough defensive backs to minimize the number one receiver on your team. And, you know, and that's maybe why the Green Bay Packers haven't, you know, reached glory since Matt LaFleur is the coach. That's why, you know, since Sammy Watkins has left, the Chiefs haven't won a Super Bowl, and, you know, like down the list. And, you know, the Rams were, you know, on track for a similar fate in that game, right? When Odell went out, like that was the last time they had a touchdown until the final drive. And that's what makes, I think, the final drive, as you said, by Stafford and Kupp, and the fact that like everybody in the stadium knew that Kupp was getting the ball and it was still, he was still able to get open, that much more remarkable. It also shows, you know, the way that the Bengals built their defense, like we said this on the last time I was on the show, was like it was a PFF defense. It was there to take advantage of the weaknesses that crop up in football. And they almost pulled it off. To the Odell point, I think that's one of the things that I think, you know, we're it's really important to take into consideration the human aspect of things, because, you know, for him, you know, he has not had it. You know, he started out, I mean, you look at some of these guys that are playing now, Jefferson and Samuel and guys like Odell had a way better start to his career than any of those guys. And now, you know, he's sort of considered an also ran in many ways. A, he still has that brilliance in him. And B, maybe some of the drop off has to do with the fact that these, you know, it's not easy to be tearing your ACL all the time, you know, and it's hard to come back and be the player that you once were. And it's, I think it takes a mental toll on a player.
Yeah, it was really tough to listen to him talk because, and it made me appreciate just how much pressure these young people are under at all time. But I mean, he was going through it with psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever the case may be, some real therapy sessions, and had come out of it. And then, of course, his dad, you know, with whatever it was on social media, came out with some videos of when he was open and not getting the ball, and basically the Cleveland Browns saying, hey, we don't want you coming into our building anymore. And they negotiated a settlement, and he ends up out there, looks like he's going to be the Super Bowl hero. And then he's just not, you know, and is sitting there on the sideline and watching this thing. It was rough. Another point that I thought was worth discussing a little bit is we saw Joe Burrow before in the first half of that game, getting the ball out of his hand so quickly, there was no way the Rams pass rush was going to get there. Now, it wasn't always successful, but you never saw that avalanche of sacks that we did see in the second half. I thought Joe had a couple of plays where he kind of moved around like he did against Kansas City, made some plays. And then all of a sudden I started thinking, uh-oh, that worked. And now is he going to get away from the quick throws, the quick releases that, even though they were behind at the end of the first half, they were, I thought, controlling the boogeyman. And the boogeyman in this game being Aaron Donald and Von Miller and the pass rush of the Rams. He was protecting his offensive line, but then he started holding it a little bit longer there in the second half. And I thought the Rams made a great adjustment in that they really did not want to blitz in the game. They wanted their four pass rushers to beat the Bengals' five offensive linemen, but that wasn't happening. That really wasn't happening, in part because Joe was getting the ball, rid of the ball so quickly, but also because they weren't blitzing. And then in the second half, they started sliding the four-man line over and then bringing the linebacker, got the one-on-ones on the running backs, and that really ended up breaking the game open.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is they sort of kept a lot of, you know, they had five sacks on plays where they disguised their coverage on Burrow, which was really interesting because Burrow this season was the number one graded quarterback when other teams disguised coverage. And the Rams, I thought, would sort of get away from that. That's kind of one of their signatures on defense. And they stuck with it in this game. And, you know, Burrow actually against sort of non-disguised coverages was, you know, he had a bad PFF grade. It was like 55.3, but he was at least able to get the ball out in those situations. But it felt like when they, well, in the data, it's absolutely clear. Like when they disguised coverage, it made him pat the ball a little bit more. And, you know, that forced some sacks, even though he did have the 75-yard touchdown on such a play and that kind of thing. So I thought Raheem Morris, you know, this season had a really hard task, right? Like you think about, you know, Kyle Shanahan giving way to Steve Sarkisian and the Falcons in 16 and 17. And, you know, other instances where a brilliant coordinator goes and gets a new job and the next guy comes in and he's like, I'm just going to run the same thing. I'm not going to change what's worked in the past. And usually those guys fail because it's not their defense, right? It's not their offense. It's not their intuition. And for Raheem Morris to sort of supercharge that defense, they weren't as efficient as last year, but, you know, they made it count, you know, numerous times, you know, especially in the playoffs. Like, I think he deserves a great deal of credit. And for, you know, like, you know, Joe Burrow was one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL this year, and he had him completely flummoxed.
I thought that was an underrated storyline, especially when you have, you know, Eric Weddle coming out of retirement for 2 years wearing the green dot and making the plays. Nick Scott, the other safety, who good player, had a great playoffs, but was a, you know, special teams ace coming into that game, to still be able to disguise things and mix things up on the back end. Weddle then also, you know, tears his pec or whatever happened in the game, and still is able to do all those things. Yeah, I thought Morris had an underrated great playoff run.
Yeah, it really did. It's a good point you guys are making. It was one that I planned on talking about quite a bit, never really got to. The game was just sort of relentless. It just, you know, there weren't like big breaks in the game where nothing was happening. But Weddle with the green dot's a great point. Nick Scott, the other safety, who made some great plays against Tampa Bay. And then Trayvon Howard, who really ended up being like one of our top graded coverage guys, coming out and playing so well, that triumphant of three backup players, really, because when Ernest Jones, the rookie linebacker, went out and he played. I thought the other guy that had a pretty significant role in the game was A'shaun Robinson. When you study that defense long enough, you know that he is the run stuffer, but they really don't want him in there in the pass rush situations, even though he ends up with a sack in the game. But I thought he played great, because when I was breaking down the game for our team, I said, if the Bengals win this game, I think that we're going to have Joe Mixon as the MVP, because they were going to have to throw the ball quickly, get the ball out of his hands. I thought we'd see a lot of checkdowns, and I thought they were going to have to be able to run the football against their non A'shaun Robinson on the field defense. But when A'shaun Robinson was in there, it seemed like he made every play. I mean, it just felt like every time he was on the field, he was making the play. And even though Joe Mixon had a really good game, what did he have, 70, 75 yards rushing, something like that, threw a touchdown pass from a halfback pass, did some really good things in the game, He didn't do enough to put the pass rush out of this game. And help Burrow enough in the game in order to do that. So anything else stick out to you guys?
Just to your point, I think an underrated part of these Fangio defenses, the one like the Rams this year, put the fewest men in the box on early downs of any team in the NFL, right? Like that's their identity. I think an underrated part of those defenses is players like A'shaun Robinson. That player needs to be able to hold the point of attack, because you have one last man in the box. And I think if you look at PFF WAR, I think he was a top 10 player this year of defensive linemen, just because I think we're factoring that in a little bit more now, where, you know, if you put fewer men in the box on early downs, it just makes you a better defense, because the other team is enticed to run the ball early in the downs. And that ultimately is a trap for an offense. So he's a big part of that. And I think that's a really good call out there, because I don't think he gets the credit on that defensive line. When you look at Miller, Floyd and Donald, obviously.
I would just jump in too and say that we got to point out, we're talking about the Rams' depth. And I think this storyline that they're this only top heavy build team and all they do is trade away picks is kind of missing the boat. I mean, they've made at least 8 draft picks in every draft since 2017. You know, we talked about A'shaun Robinson, but Greg Gaines also plays some one tech, has a big role. Talked about Ernest Jones already. They have guys at every spot that can come in and play an important role. And that's not by accident.
No, it wasn't. And especially when you considered, you know, it was such a key part of the matchup with Jalen Ramsey, and how was he going to do? Would he be matched up against Ja'Marr Chase and all that? And you probably would have to say it wasn't Jalen Ramsey's best day. Now, it wasn't his fault. And the catch by Ja'Marr Chase, the one-handed catch down the sideline, was as good as anything I think we've ever seen in the Super Bowl. So, you know, and the other one, he didn't get a penalty called. But at the same time, if you would have said that Chase was going to have that kind of success and Higgins was going to have a net that play, even though it probably shouldn't have counted, you would have liked the Bengals in this game. But all those other guys, and then you begin to wonder, would the Rams have been here but for the deals that they made? So even though Odell Beckham goes out of the game, he still was a huge part of the early part of that game. And even though we're going to talk about Aaron Donald and what he did in this game, is he doing that if it's not for the fact that Von Miller was there and sort of was able to make up some of this, and that Eric Weddle came out of retirement. And, you know, it was those other guys in the game that added the kind of depth you're talking about, Brad, that really, to me, stuck out in the whole playoff run, along with Nick Scott and Traven Howard and some of the guys we talked about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're going to think about in our R&D group is development, right? So I think a lot of this draft season, we sort of, there's a lot of research on, you know, after you adjust for draft position, there isn't really a team that drafts better than any other team. And so then the question becomes, like, how does a team like the Rams, maybe it's just luck, but how do they get value out of players who are clearly like lower draft capital because of the way that they've constructed their team? And I'm trying to think of, you know, there's a possibility that coaching staff and that, you know, and one of their things is they never get injured. I know Odell got hurt and Robert Woods did, but if you look at their season-long injury rates, it's required that they have that kind of health to do the sort of stars and scrubs sort of, you know, team makeup that they do. And so I think, you know, it's hard not to like go back and look at the Super Bowl champion and say, hey, what did they do right, and try to prescribe that for the rest of the league. But I do think the Rams provide a decent case study for certain ideas that maybe, you know, we overlooked. Because again, like, I think a lot of people, myself included, sort of doubted the Rams because of their team building and that kind of thing. But ultimately they overcame a lot of that, which is, you know, kudos to them.
Yeah, Brad, one of the things that they really rely on, and I've got to at least mention the name Cooper Kupp here at the end of the Super Bowl recap, what those two guys were able to do together. I mean, they wake up every day, they get into the facility, have breakfast together, talking about Cooper Kupp and Matthew Stafford at 6 a.m. The hard work paid off, all the details. I thought the throw, sort of the deep slant, whatever that thing was in between defenders, was among the best plays I've seen all year, and keeping that drive alive. So those guys were phenomenal. But the one thing that Eric hit on was some of these compensatory picks. So if you have a high price free agent, and or not even free agent, a player walks away from your team, you do get like those third round picks. And so we're seeing more and more and more around the league that these teams that don't have first round draft picks, if they lose two or three players, they get two or three of these third round picks, they use one of them to trade up to get a second rounder, whatever the case is, there is a method to the madness out there. And I honestly have at times wondered whether or not those compensatory picks now are too good, and is a third rounder too high? Because that is a game that moves you outside of the draft only kind of thing to be able to make this thing work. Your thoughts on those compensatory picks and how teams are using them, like the Rams, like the Patriots, the way they have over the years?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. The Rams have been one of the leaders in compensatory picks. Funny enough, the Bengals actually have as well. But, you know, we talked about Ernest Jones. He is a third round compensatory selection. I think it's also, you know, with the Rams now as well, losing Brad Holmes as general manager to the Detroit Lions. So they get those compensatory picks as well. But for the free agent approach, I mean, yeah, it takes patience, though. It takes letting a guy like a Dante Fowler, coming off a 12 sack season, letting him walk. Atlanta signs him to a big deal, and he hasn't really done anything since. And so I get folks that kind of think it's a bit of a rigged system, and it's in favor of, you know, teams like Baltimore, New England are always in the top. Dallas does a good job as well, but it's because they are making those tough decisions and not keeping every single guy in tow. It's a smart thing to exploit, and they are one of the leaders in that regard.
It's a really interesting system, but you know, those teams didn't make the rules. They're just playing by them. And as long as that is going to be in place, you're going to see, and it kind of works against the players, probably sometimes, because there's not a desperation to keep a 12 sack guy on your team, because you're going to get a young player. Usually those are older players. You're going to get a draft pick. And if you get enough of them, then they can turn into second or even first round picks at some point. One of the things that was an interesting part of the game for us is after the football game, halftime was great. You could feel the energy in the stadium. It was just, it was fun. It was, as my kids say, they finally made a halftime for the rest of us instead of the 50 and up crowd out there. But we got a chance to meet Eminem after the game. He's a big fan of Al Michaels, and it was really fun. But I've never met a guy that was more different than what I was thinking I was going to meet. He was very humble. He was like, such an football guy. Like, he couldn't believe he was sitting there talking football with Al and I after the game. And it was really fun, but he was talking about his own performance. And he goes, "Oh, I hate performing live. I was so nervous out there." Oh, and he's like this very humble, sort of soft-spoken guy that, you know, I guess, you know, watching 8 Mile or whatever, you might've picked up on some of that stuff. But it also was, you know, you forget sometimes, I was talking about how the young players and all the pressure they're under. All these guys are young people put on a stage in front of 112 million people that watch the Super Bowl. You would have to experience this to understand what Eminem was saying, was that, oh my gosh, I was so nervous out there.
Yeah. I will say to your son's point about feeling that the shows were usually for older folks, that we kind of had a moment among my friends where we realized that it kind of was for older folks, and those older folks are now us kind of entering our 30s. So that was a bit of a wake-up call. But that's cool to hear that he's humble. I thought it was maybe the best halftime show I've ever seen.
Don't you think, because it's interesting, right? Because people who have reached a rarefied air, I sort of think about you know, even talking to you, Chris, but like other people in the industry, like Mike Tirico and folks like that, who, you know, you talk to them and you're like, you know, oh, I remember this game and I remember that guy. I remember the call you had or whatever. And, you know, you'll say something like, oh man, I actually fumbled that call. It should have been this, 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 and this. And you're like, oh yeah. Like, you know, people who are like Eminem, you know, they have doubts about themselves just the same way that all of us do. You know, it's sort of it's interesting, right? And like, it takes a level of confidence to be that great at something. But it also takes humility to be that great at something for that long. You know what I mean? So I feel like that, you know, we are surprised when that happens. But you know, it's probably a characteristic of somebody who ends up being good and being able to hone their craft and evolve over time and things like that.
Well, when you're, and I think we understand this at PFF a little bit now, going into whatever this is, our 16th year or something, that over time, your product gets beat up, right? Over time, NFL teams and college teams and consumers and gamblers and fantasy players and all the people that we deal with all beat us up in one way or another. They all, if you make a mistake, it gets pointed out 10 million times. And after a while, it does create there is no feeling like going with the opening on camera and going, hello, 112 million people, how are you here? You know, and you're like, well, what the heck? Let's go.
Well, so, and I think people don't realize that, right? Like, I remember, you know, one of the first times you and I ever talked, it was kind of right after that Super Bowl. Well, it was, you know, right after that Super Bowl, the Eagles Patriots, where, you know, I think people believed that you were being malicious towards the Eagles. And in reality, like, you wrestled with how to handle a few of those calls yourself, right? And I don't think people really understand that. I don't think people, I think people underestimate the amount of care that like people have towards things that are borderline, and how there's not a good choice sometimes, right? Like, you're choosing between pissing one group of people off and pissing another group of people off. And so you just make the choice that you think is best, and there's no, you know, and I think for somebody like Eminem, like, obviously, like you said, like, you know, over time, people are like, oh, was he really that good? Or, you know, was it, you know, he hasn't produced anything like, you know, great next number of years, like what happened to him and all this stuff. And like, I can't imagine he doesn't live with that internally. Right. And so, but I thought he was great in the halftime show. I thought the halftime show was great. I also hit all my bets on the halftime show, which is nice.
There
Chris,
you go. What were your bets?
Well, Lose Yourself was the only song that Eminem would do by himself. That was a bet. I think who would go out first was Snoop or Dre. It was actually kind of touchy because it was kind of ambiguous as to who went first. So I bet both of them, but they were both like plus money. So that ended up working out. The anthem went over. A lot of people thought she'd go under. That was a pretty interesting set of like sort of non-football props in that game.
There you go. You can bet on anything right now. It is interesting that Philadelphia thing with the two calls that were questionable. And one of these days I'm writing a long book that's going to tell the whole thing. I'll just say this. Back in the day, we used to be pretty stealth with how we handled officials' calls. But anybody who thinks that I was up there making those calls and second guessing those judgments on my own, I will say that's probably not the case. But now it's so, thank God we have Terry McCauley in there and he gets to do that. And I think if we had one thing to do over in this Super Bowl at the end of that, we probably would have brought Terry in on that third down and seven, the pass interference call. But I think that looking around, you know, I can kind of see him as well. But when it's kind of unanimous amongst us and every one of us thought that there really wasn't anything. And the only thing I'll say that made me hesitate a little bit was there was the slant, the hold on the pass interference in the first half of that game where they had the t-shirt pull or whatever underneath the thing that you couldn't see it until we got to the third replay. Like I didn't see anything at all. And then you could see on the third replay, the little tug of it. So sometimes that third, fourth, fifth replay especially when you're in a Super Bowl is when you actually do see the foul. And sometimes an official or one of our guys will see it before we see it. But it's wild. I mean, it is, you're talking about the world stage. And I guess other than the World Cup, that's about as big as you're going to get. And it's wild, but a lot of fun. Got to meet Eminem. That was fun. Everything was great in the game. I thought the Bengals, even in a losing cause, probably developed more of a fan base during this playoff run. They're young, they're hip, they're exciting, they're fun to watch. And I would imagine we're going to see them at least twice, maybe three times on Sunday Night Football next year.
Yeah, it should be great. I mean, I was sort of hoping, you know, I wasn't really rooting for anybody. I thought my bets were kind of like even on both sides, but like having opening Thursday Night Football in Cincy would have been fun, huh?
Would have been interesting. Would have been interesting indeed. Hoops fans, the latest offer from DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA, is too good to pass up. I'm talking about Between the Legs, 360 windmill, kind of good. New customers can bet just $1, that's $1, on any team and get $150 in free bets if they win. It's just that simple. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, you can still take your shot at a big payday. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Basketball Contests. And DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their very first deposit. So download the DraftKings Sportsbook app right now. Use promo code PFF. Bet just $1 on any NBA team and get $150 in free bets if they win. That is promo code, drumroll please, PFF at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. 21 years or older, minimum age and location requirements vary by jurisdiction. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for a full list of requirements and state-specific responsible gaming resources. If you have a gambling problem, though, please call 1-800-GAMBLER. This Chris Collinsworth podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. While you focus on your roster moves, Western and Southern helps advance your money moves. Buying your first home, who hasn't been there? Planning to start a family, been there too, wondering how to make your money grow? definitely been there in Western and Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions help you rest assured on game day. So team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. Right now, you can get 25% off any PFF subscription if you use promo code Collinsworth. There you go. What can you get with a PFF subscription? Well, listen to this. All of PFF's locked article content. Oh, it's all the good stuff. The NFL draft guide, not only for this year, for next year, when you're watching the teams play. Completely unlocked mock draft simulator, which is the coolest thing you've ever seen. 2022 free agent rankings, data and grades from the entire 2021 season. So, of course, going into next fantasy season, that is invaluable, and so, so much more. So support the podcast, help me pay for all the great young people working on this thing, and use promo code Collinsworth for 25% off any sub. Brad, let's go on now to a couple of points here. You're always, I love talking to you in the off season. You're always ahead of the curve here a little bit. There's so many different things going on, and the quarterbacks obviously are going to be the primary point of conversation as we go along. But let's talk about a couple of wide receivers that are going to be front and center here as well. I start with Adams and how that is so closely, or at least the perception is, tied to Aaron Rodgers, but it really isn't, is it? I mean, because you do have, you know, the possibility of the Packers with a few cards to play here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why you would let Devontae Adams go, even if you do decide to move on to Jordan Love. I mean, having a guy like him for your next quarterback would obviously go a long way. And his situation is interesting. It's unique because of the way DeAndre Hopkins was paid, because of the way Julio Jones was paid. But I'll tell you, there was this rumor floating around for a while that he was asking for up to $30 million per year, wanted to become the highest paid non-quarterback in the NFL. And I didn't buy it for a long time, but I spoke to a couple folks that I think would have a good idea on that, and that is a legitimate request. We'll see if he gets it, but he wants to become one of the highest, if not the highest paid non-quarterbacks. I think the interesting question there is, you know, is a wide receiver worth that? We've kind of had that conversation with Ja'Marr Chase, you know, going top five in the draft, and I think a guy like Devontae probably is worth that much money.
Yeah, it's we're up to – from, I want to say, what was it, 180 something, we're up to $208 million on the salary cap right now. So either a couple of these wide receivers are going to get it, or the quarterbacks are going to get everything, you know? And so what I begin to wonder about is, are we now going to see an era where we were like, oh my gosh, Patrick Mahomes made $45 million a year, where that may end up being a quaint little salary, and we see the first 50, maybe even $60 million contract. And can you justify something like that if you're at 208?
I think Aaron Rodgers surpassing $50 million per year is a very real possibility. I think an extension with Green Bay could approach that, you know, 4 years, $200 million type range, potentially, because, yeah, I mean, the salary cap is going to spike. And as you said, it all starts with the quarterbacks and everything trickles down from there. And that's why signing Mahomes to a 10-year deal at $45 million per year. And, you know, a lot of our cap folks were saying that's a phenomenal deal for the Chiefs. It's going to age wonderfully. It's going to look great in a couple of years. And everyone thought we were crazy, but I'd be pretty surprised if there aren't multiple guys passing Mahomes this offseason. And yeah, a couple of years down the road, we are going to look at it and say, what a discount they got on Patrick Mahomes for $500 million.
I'll even double down on what Brad said. Like, the way things look now, I would bet, I would go to DraftKings, a very loyal sponsor of PFF, and go and bet Green Bay to win the NFC North right now. It's like minus 165. That's like the cheapest you're ever going to get it. I think Rodgers looks at the rest of the league and then looks at his own division and says, okay, I'll do all the juice cleanses I can in this town here. Like, I think I, you know, even without Adams, and I know Adams is a big deal, and like Brad has done such a great job of explaining these things to me. I mean, the hardest, wide receiver is a hard position because the top three people, and then when Adams gets signed here, in average per year are all over 30. But there's also this distance between like Julio Jones at 22 million APY and DeAndre Hopkins at 27.25 APY. Everybody looks at that trade and thinks, oh my gosh, Houston got fleeced. But like the Cardinals signed Hopkins to, I would say, one of the weirdest deals in the history of the league. And that deal is sort of really hurting some of these like elite wide receivers, I feel like, in their negotiations with other teams. Because, right, Brad? I mean, I don't think like a wide receiver can, you know, say, well, that's the goal now when there's a $5 million gap between Hopkins and anybody else.
So that's the holdup with Adams, is that Hopkins' deal was a two-year extension on top of the 3 years he had remaining from his Houston contract, whereas Adams is obviously his deal would start in 2022. So that's why I think my projection on the website is 4 years, $100 million at $25 million per year, and it still would be an extremely strong deal, strong guarantees, all of that. And in a lot of, you know, in my opinion, that would be the top deal on the market, even though Hopkins' deal, you know, is 27.25. But yes, that caused a lot of heartache across the league when that extension came through.
Here's what I would do if I were Brian Gutekunst. I would, at the very least, Aaron Rodgers and maybe Aaron and Devontae, bring them in, right? Just the three of us are going to be in the room. And especially with Aaron, I would go, all right, Aaron, here's the deal. Name your number. I've got $208 million to work with there. You name the number. What's the most important to you? Is it most important? You want me to pay you $50 million? I'll pay you $50 million. You want me to pay you $60 million? I'll pay you $60 million. I don't care. But Tom Brady, yes, he had a supermodel wife. Tom Brady took a little less because at some point in his life, money was important, but winning those rings was more important. So here's the deal. If I pay you 60, that means I got to get rid of Devontae. I've got to get rid of this guy. Our offensive line is going to be a bunch of kids up there, and you're probably not going to win, and you're probably going to get killed, right? So there's the consequences. But I would sit back. I would go, here's how I plan on distributing that $208 million. It's going to include Devontae in there, but this is on you at this point. I will pay you, you write it down on that contract, whatever number you want, and then let's begin to talk about the consequences of what that means for this football team going forward. But we got to have you. I cannot have you walk out of this room. So you want to write down $80 million? Write down $80 million, and we'll figure it out from there, but understand the ramifications of that.
Yeah, no, I do think that's a sell, and I'm sure it's conversations they've tried to have. And I think my pitch would be, add up all the money that Tom Brady is going to make from documentaries and all these things because he won those rings and all these ceremonies and all that, and say, maybe you can bridge the gap to where, I mean, look, Rodgers is still going to be a Hall of Famer. He's still got his State Farm spot and everything, but try to argue that there will be more off-field earnings if he does win three rings. But if he takes $65 million a year, he's not going to get those three rings.
Eric, let's hit on a point that Brad made, because I think it's really an interesting one. And maybe it's just because it was the position I played in the NFL, playing receiver. But I played a whole bunch of quarterback before that as well. But Devontae, Chris Godwin, Mike Williams, you know, there's some really good players coming up here that are going to be set for big paydays at the end of this. The relative value of the wide receiver position. So let's take quarterback out of it for a minute. So quarterback is one, two, and three, however you want to say it. It's beyond extreme how valuable that position is. Where is wide receiver? And on a relative scale, so let's just, for the sake of argument, let's put Aaron Rodgers at $50 million. Where does that put Devontae Adams in your mind on relative value and building through the salary cap?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because wide receiver, I think on average, has less of an impact possibly than like tackle. Like, so we had this Jamar Chase, Penei Sewell conversation for, you know, from now last year, basically till now, right? And the idea being, and there was a time this season where Penei Sewell had more wins above replacement than Jamar Chase, because he had been consistently good all year, and Jamar Chase kind of had an up and down year. Obviously, when you added it all up, he was great, and he ultimately finished. I think for an offense to have outsized, for an offense to be consistently elite, you need a consistently elite wide receiver. So you know, the classic example for me is, you know, Tom Brady is the best quarterback in the history of the NFL. The 2006 Patriots made the AFC Championship game, ultimately a limited team, ultimately wasn't able to get it done. And they get Randy Moss the next year. And we don't forget, you know, Wes Welker was also a very good player on that team too. But Randy Moss took that team and bumped them up against that number one spot as an offense consistently, right? In Minnesota, he did the same thing. Chris Carter and Jake Reed were, four straight 1,000 yard seasons for both those men. And he took them and they've set the point scored record. To me, the Packers are a consistently elite offense because of Davante Adams. And so I put his number at 25. I would say, you know, when you look at wins above replacement, it's a little bit weird, and Brad can maybe explain this a little bit better, but the if you were to have a truly free market, I would say the quarterback would be the quarterbacks that got paid a ton. So like a guy like Adams would earn 25 million and a guy like Rodgers would earn 100. That's kind of how I would see it. And if you didn't have things like the franchise tag and that kind of thing, you would see runaway salaries for these quarterbacks. But the wide receiver position would be somewhere in that second spot. And the reason is that what we have been statisticians call tail, the tail events, which mean like the events that are extreme that can push a team like the Bengals from 4 wins to 10 wins and the Super Bowl. That's what a wide receiver can do that a tackle can't. And I think what we're seeing in Green Bay is they're in that sort of 13 win range because they have Adams playing that well. If Adams were to fall off or leave, then they would be more of a normal team. They'd be struggling in that 9-10 win range, in my opinion.
I think just to talk to the Patriots a little bit, because, you know, even growing up myself, I always used to think how, and you mentioned, of course, secondary receivers are super important. And so for the longest time, they really did not have a high paid guy there. Deion Branch was the top guy for a while and so on and so forth. But that, I think, was the genius of them investing so much in the tight end position, was because that market is so much lower than wide receiver. When you make Gronk the highest paid tight end, it's still, you know, 50% of what the top of the market at wide receiver was. And so I think that got lost a little bit as well, as folks would say, Brady's proven that you don't need good receivers. You just want to have a bunch of options, guys that can get open, get yards after the catch. Yeah, you also have probably the greatest tight end to ever play, and he's making $10 million a year when receivers are making 20.
And we'll talk about that plenty as we go down the road here as well. When we get into some of these situations, is a certain player, Gesicki, a wide receiver or a tight end, and all the different things that come with that too. So, but you guys are fantastic. I can't wait for the off season. We get a chance to play the game that we all love. We all want to be the general manager. We just don't want the responsibility for having to win football games after that. But thank you guys so much. And we're off and running with rebuild your football teams for the next football season. So that was great. Thanks, guys.
Can't wait.
Thank you.